Gracious God, you who give life, you who redeem life, and you who sustain life, come to us now and forgive us for our desires to take the life of another. Come to us now and redeem us from our desires to end our own lives in such a variety of ways, for refusing to separate, from refusing to hear your word as it is given to us, and trying to cling to do things by yourself. Deliver us from ourselves. Root us in your word, in your Son, Jesus Christ, that we may become a part of the community to share with one another the life and the gifts that you have given to us, to share and open us that we may receive the gifts that others have to offer to us, for your glory and for the glory of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
This morning, if you can't see a Bible, you better get one, because the verse is really long and you won't be able to follow. And I just want you to note that you will have a test before you leave if you have memorized the verse. I apologize, I think I told some people verse 18, that was inappropriate. It's verse 13. If I did do that, I apologize to you. Chapter 20 of Exodus, verse 13. Verse 13. I will attempt to read it here and not get too exhausted. You shall not kill. Some may have noted that I changed the order or even added some different questions up here. I want to do something a little different this morning, partly because I'm not concerned what jumps out at you from this, from the text, because it may club us so hard we may end up being the ones who are killed. And so I want to do a few different things this morning with this text. Change the order of questions, and then add some other questions specifically to this text to spur us on to some discussion. Then I want to share the story a little bit earlier in our hour together rather than at the end, and then reflect on the story. I think it's unfair sometimes. There are sometimes I hear sermons that I want to stop the preacher in the middle of and say, let's discuss that for a second. At one point in a parish, in fact it was during the season of Pentecost, when we had, I believe it was like four or five Sundays in a row, the kingdom of God is light. And I did that, not during the service, but I preached on that, and then we had a forum immediately after, and it was delightful for the people to interact with the sermon and images and stuff like that. So I want to do that this morning with this story. And to do that, pick up two of the notions that Jose presented yesterday in looking at Scripture with some different questions. And two of the questions he presented to us yesterday were, where's the power and the powerlessness in the story or in the text? He was using a scriptural text. I want to use the story and say, who has the power and who's powerless in that story? And then secondly, what if we reassign the cast of characters? In other words, what if we change roles and identify ourselves with someone else in that story? Would it take a different shape and how so? Okay, let's start. Text within the context. What comes before and what comes after? What's the setting, in other words, of this exhaustive verse, you shall not kill? What's the setting? Anyone?
The giving of the law in Mount Sinai.
Okay. The giving of the law, the Ten Commandments are given on Mount Sinai. Where have the people come from? From Egypt. They have crossed through the sea, and they have gone through this struggle already of determining how they are going to survive in the wilderness. Prior to this, you have the gathering of leaders, in some sense, we could say, and saying, gosh, Moses, it really would have been better just to stay in Egypt, because at least we had food, and at least we knew what we were expected to do. Now here we're out in the wilderness, and there's no food, and we don't know what's going to happen. They're given the bread, given the meat, and the water in three miraculous ways. That's the setting here. Moses has left them and now come back down from the mountain with this law, with these commandments. What follows? What goes on from here?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, please.
What is the context of the law before them? That is, what commandments were given? What kind of laws did the people have to follow?
Did everyone hear the question? The question had to do before the giving of the Ten Commandments. What was the law that the people lived by? Fair enough.
Right.
Okay. Anyone?
In some ways, I'd say there probably weren't any formal laws. Exodus is probably the first thing that comes to us as far as written down. There were, but one thing I would say though, that there are sort of the laws of the manna.
Yeah.
In the sense that there's a certain kind of way of living with the manna that God was giving to the people of Egypt as they came through the wilderness. It's like you don't take any more than you need. And because it's going to spoil if you take more, and you don't pick it up on the Sabbath, and those kinds of laws that are, but they're not formal sort of commandments in the sense that this is.
Okay. Let me ask the question to clarify that for a second for myself. Law meaning what? My relationship with neighbors? My relationship with God? Law being what?
Both. And what I was wondering is, I've always wondered this, is was there a sense of what it means to kill, what it means to steal? That is, was there a sense in the people at that time, the chaoticness resulting from not having law? What was their sense? How would they accept these laws?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's certainly this question. What did they hear then?
Right.
And that's fine. We can move to that. That's all right. Yeah.
Well, if you look back in 18, there had been a problem. Apparently, Moses was the only person distributing justice throughout all the tribes. It was too overwhelming. And Jethro comes to visit.
Yep.
And he says, you're going to drive yourself crazy if you keep this up. He says, you have to divide it up into smaller pieces. And then only the big questions have brought to you. Mm-hmm. So there had been chaos before, of some degree. And there had been then a mechanism of dispensation. But there apparently have been no formal sets of how those people down at each level actually determined what they did. They probably fell back on a tradition from Egypt.
Sure. Exactly.
Moses is an excellent example of Michael's illustration of the Lone Ranger, for those who heard his example yesterday, and the image that Jose picked up yesterday as well. It's quite interesting that both of them used the same analogy of the Lone Ranger and Tonto, a little differently, emphasis on Tonto, but certainly on the Lone Ranger. I think there was a sense of that killing was wrong, story of Cain and Abel. It was inappropriate. And interestingly, how God marks Cain and says, just because Cain has done a stupid and inappropriate behavior does not give someone else the right to do the same to him. Interesting follow through on that. There's also the giving in the story of the Garden of Eden, and after the creation of Ish and Isha, or male and female there are things they can do and can't do. So there is already a law stating what is an inappropriate behavior even within the garden. And that is to have another God. I mean, that's kind of what the tree of knowledge represents, turning away from God. So not permitted to do that. I think that's also part of what's behind the story of the manna and the quails, and that desire to hoard the food, and in some sense the food becomes the representation of God. They have it now, they're safe. No longer need to be dependent upon God. I have my enough food, and it just rots on them. Flush more out though, because you're on to a good question here, and I know we haven't answered it yet.
Well, there's a whole bunch of issues, I think, that come out when I think about thou shalt not kill. One of them is there is a hierarchy. Is there a hierarchy in sin? It is the first...
Some worse than others.
Right. Now, in our society, there is. Is that correct?
Okay, hold that for a second if you can. That's
no issue.
That's good. That's good. Let me just back up so we get everybody... One second, let me get everybody at the same place here. What comes after is a spelling out very thoroughly of what, how this law now is going to take place in your life, and it is very detailed. Very detailed. 613 ways it becomes so detailed of how it is spelled out. I'm sorry, didn't mean to catch on.
Most of the other religions, one of the distinguishing aspects of what we would call the pagan religions or whatever, other than Judeo-Christianity, is that this is a moral religion governing a man's relation to his fellow man, whereas the others, and what most of these people were dealing with, it spelled out whatever they were, whatever gods they believed in, their relationship to their God only.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as their relationship to a fellow man, that depended primarily on the type of government leadership or whatever. In other words, whoever was strongest had the right to do pretty much anything they wanted, on down to the slaves who had no rights. And as far as any type of codification of laws, there was very little at that time.
Okay. Keep that question though. Let's keep wrestling with that, because that's behind us all, very much so. And that plays into this one then. What did the community of the Koinonia in the wilderness now here? And that somewhat is, we can't answer that unless we kind of know what was beforehand, as you alluded to. What was their notion? Was there a notion of killing is inappropriate, or you just do it whenever you want? What did this community hear?
Life has value.
Life has value, okay?
Primary message of God, and I think they sort of heard it, is that this is what you need to do to live as a community, as my community, as my people. And this is the way you need to set up your life together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, this is what you need to do.
Okay.
This is what community means. This is what it means to be an alternative community in the midst of other settings, other cultures, other religions.
Yes.
But if you're to be my people, this is what you need.
Yeah.
Would this have anything to do with this eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth situation?
How so?
Well, which if somebody injured another, you had the right to injure them back. If somebody killed your son, you had the right to kill their son.
Okay. So. And you're saying that that was a part of this?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yes. That was the code. And that was the way of if you do harm to someone, there is a consequence, and it will be of equal severity.
But in connection with that, I think I read someplace too, where that eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was an improvement.
Yes.
On the old system,
yes.
Which was unlimited revenge. And so an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was an improvement.
It was very much so. It was seen as a just improvement of making things, quote unquote, fair now.
Only in common.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Yeah, also, I think that what they heard was confusion, because as they went through and codified the law, they listed a number of offenses for which death was the appropriate punishment.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you shall not kill, and then it says, you shall not allow a sorcerer to live.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't seem quite eye for an eye.
Well, this is the whole concept of the state only having the power to kill. The beginning of that.
Yes. It was not the person harmed who had the right to kill, but the governing authorities who had that authorities and power. So it was done orderly. It was killing, but it was killing done orderly. Does that make it any better?
Pardon me?
It depends upon one's viewpoint.
Yeah. Let's move down here. What does it mean to kill?
What is this?
It's killing.
And with that, what about murder?
Is there a difference? Are they the same thing, to murder and to kill? Can we interchange those? Does anyone here have the new RSV? Someone want to read what verse 18 says? Verse 13, chapter 20 says?
You shall not murder.
The change. You had the...
Mine was the NIV.
What does that one say? I guess it probably says murder, too. Can we have the good news?
13.
International says what?
Murder.
Yeah,
murder.
You shall not murder. Okay. Are they the same? Are they interchangeable terms? Can we interchange murder and kill?
No. You can kill a spirit, but murder is final.
Kill a spirit.
You can kill.
Well,
the spirit
you can kill somebody's desire to do without killing them physically.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. That's
yeah, in the back.
I see kill as to destroy.
To destroy.
To destroy something or someone. Murder would be to take someone's life.
Okay.
I see it in the... compare it in two different ways. You're in an automobile, you make the wrong turn, run into another automobile and kill a person. You killed him.
Okay.
Is that murder? Or I decide to kill a person. I plot and go about that as Cain. The Cain and Abel situation, is that murder or kill? Those are two different situations as I would see it.
Okay. One involving some intent, some forethought, being murdered. Mm-hmm.
The question there is whether intent in the one case is equivalent to the negligence in the other case.
Right.
Of course, this gets into all those 900 points of the law that
yeah.
differentiate. God interested in differentiating.
Right. Yeah.
Do kill and murder have a sense of, we talked about murdering a person, and so we switch it to murder, then that helps us with, we shall not murder a person, but it's okay to kill a beef cattle to eat. Somehow kill can be okay with an animal, we don't talk about murdering an animal.
Okay. What about putting value then on life to different degrees, perhaps, and therefore discussing the terms? Yeah.
My question is, when they did the new RSV, why did they change the word? What was the research and study that got into that?
I don't know. I'm not a Hebrew scholar at all. My area is more in New Testament Greek. My Hebrew is long gone.
I don't know what they did there.
Yeah. Well, it certainly leaves the military or the soldiers, you know, the question when it says, thou shalt not murder.
Okay.
That sort of takes them off the hook. And that's what a lot of these young men, women struggle with when they go to war. Mm-hmm. Because thou shalt not kill, I mean, that's what's happening. But they say if it says thou shalt not murder, sort of puts it a little different.
Okay, so you're saying that perhaps there was some political intent on the choice of words there then?
It almost sounds like.
Okay. I just saw another hand over here.
Well, I was just going to say that newspapers certainly differentiate between kill and murder. Yeah. Like he's talking about a car wreck. So many people were killed.
Yeah.
And somebody went out and shot somebody, he went out and murdered somebody.
Yeah.
Newspapers certainly use it.
Unless, of course, there was alcohol in the person who caused the accident, then they say they murdered him. There was another hand, yeah.
I recall vaguely a discussion that C.S. Lewis wrote on this in Mere Christianity when he was talking about the difference between killing and murdering, the difference between whether one derives a sense of satisfaction or delight from what one has done.
Mm-hmm. Back to the somewhat intense again. Yes. The hand up here. Yeah.
I think if you were to speak to the victim or his family, it wouldn't make much of a difference.
Yeah.
Good. Do you feel he was killed or murdered? Any person who did.
Good comment.
That's right.
The comment was, if you were to talk to the victim's family, how would they identify what happened? Would they say he was killed, she killed, or were they murdered?
Or the victim himself.
Or the victim, yeah. Although it'd be kind of hard.
Given the opportunity to speak.
Yeah.
I think it would be semantics at that point.
Sure. Oh, definitely. You're right. I'm dead. Was that, did they kill you or did they murder you? I'm dead.
What about execution then, if you go back to C.S. Lewis? That intrigues me with intent or satisfaction.
Yeah.
Many people that now, in fact, did you hear the latest thing where people are going to be allowed in to watch?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's kind of.
Or for those of you who are of the ELCA, there's a statement on the death penalty now that we will be discussing at the churchwide assembly down in Orlando on the death penalty. There's one on death penalty, one on abortion, and then the overall social statement that will be debated. And this is one of the issues involved there. You know, how do we define kill murder?
Could I put it in a little bit different context? I think what we've been talking about so far is an individual's act. That is, you're talking about a person involved in killing somebody, and there's, you know, in that sense, it's an individual act. Is that really what the commandment is saying? Thou shalt not kill. When you see a person in the street and you don't help him and he dies, aren't you part in the killing process? If you see people that are starving to death in Europe and you don't help, aren't you part of the killing process? Do you have to have, does it have to be an individual act?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Two things. I remember a long, long time ago going through this kind of discussion and hearing someone who obviously had more knowledge of Hebrew than I, but who said that the word, the Hebrew word to use there for kill, did have the connotation of to murder. However, I mean, this has been around for a long time. It's not something that came up just recently with the translation. That's something that, in translation, any of you who have done any of that, that it's very, very easy to slant things the way you want them to go, especially since the text here is obviously a very ancient one. It's very difficult to go back to find any contemporary literature with which to compare, to draw conclusions. One of the biggest problems, though, we're all looking at this from one standpoint,
what does the killing do or the murdering do to the person who commits the act? It's the dehumanizing, whether it's done with intent to kill, whether I'm a soldier under command to pull that trigger, or whether I do it of my own volition, that the harm ultimately beside to the victim by denying him or her of his life, the dehumanization of the person who does that, which is one of the biggest problems that we face today with this glorification of violence on TV. Vicariously, we are being dehumanized by being a part of that, by witnessing it, by approving of it, by being invited in to watch an execution.
And I assure you, I did not pay him to say that, having read my story. You haven't heard my story yet, have you? Go ahead. There's another hand over here.
I have this life application Bible, and it has the Ten Commandments said, and then what Jesus said. And interesting, across from "You shall not murder," it says in Matthew 5:22, "If you are angry with brother or sister, you may be liable to judgment."
Okay. And if you say, "You fool," you are liable to judgment. If you look at that Matthew, we looked at it yesterday briefly, Matthew 5:21 and following, Jesus goes on and said, if you will even say, "You fool," you are liable to judgment as a part of that form of killing.
I think we're broadening the text probably more than it should be broadened, because this looked like to me a basic set of rules for living together as a community.
Okay.
And later on, there are, like, the organization can kill, like we're talking about the witches. And also, when they go over into other lands, they systematically murder everybody in the land. And that follows later on in the account here. It seems that if there's any consistency, you have to take it back to the very first laws of the community and not expand it too far outside of what this probably really means.
Okay, for that community.
For that community.
Now, the question becomes, can we use that and expand it for our community in a different setting? Or is that doing too much injustice to the text?
Well, I just wonder about that. I mean, I think the broadening of it raises a lot of questions. But I think if we want to hear what the text has to say, I think we have to hear what it says to that group of people. Mm-hmm. I think probably it was a community law. You don't go around murdering people.
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Way to live together.
Right.
But why? I mean, that's why I brought up what I said. Do you take the laws from God as a bunch of dummies, not being able to evaluate why God gave us the law? Or do you take them and think about what God is saying? That is, what happens if you don't do this? And I think in the context that I brought it out, the reason I did is that I think we're all involved in the killing process. And why did I say that? I say that because if you take this law in the context of the earth and the chaoticness associated with the death that's going on in the earth, take it beyond our own U.S., beyond our own community, I see it as a chaoticness and a neglect on the part of the people in our country and other countries. And so in that context, that's the way I would see this. But it would be through thinking through that process. What is the reason for this law?
I think it's possible to write into biblical verses what your concerns are, as opposed to what they talk about. You know, that might be very appropriate. I think if you go into Matthew, where we were just talking about the parallels that Jesus said, I think that is a very appropriate thing to do. But in terms of this particular verse, I think it's more narrow than that. If you take it, I think it says it values life, and that whether this is diminution.
looking at the community, and if you, mm-hmm. you take just the steps further down the Bible, you're suddenly eliminating this as being only, you know, if you pick it outside of this context and you look at the organization, they do kill. If you look at the group of Israelites themselves, they murder everybody in the land. You have to be, I think you have to be very careful, because these things follow very closely on what actually, how this worked out, how they must have interpreted these laws, and how God actually interpreted them for them by telling them what to do.
Yeah. Which moves this into this next question. Is there ever a time or place when it is appropriate to kill?
They thought so.
Pardon me?
I said they thought so.
They thought so.
The Hebrews.
Okay, definitely.
The Old Testament atmosphere was much more vengeful and also open to much less interpretation. There was much less interpretation invited, I feel, of the Old Testament than of the New Testament.
Well, certainly among the people as a whole, but that was the work of the people of the synagogue, but the rabbis, the Talmud, that was, that's what that was.
But that comes much later, though, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, back there in the north.
It's through the idea of valuing life, and well, there is a story from the, it's either from the Midrash or one of the other commentaries on the Hebrew scriptures, but God is up talking with the angels, and they see the water sweeping over the Egyptians in the Red Sea, and the Israelites had made it safely to the other side. And the angels are singing this great song of jubilation, and God says, quiet, can't you see that my children are perishing?
I guess what I was going to say has something to do with that. I guess for me, the question would be, just because the Hebrew people killed in the Old Testament, does that mean that they were actually following what God had originally given? And there's certainly accounts where it's told as though God is telling them this is what you should do. But I guess the question I would say is, there's a whole line of prophets that are constantly saying we need to return to the Mosaic covenant, and we've lost it. And we've lost this sense of community that God has given us. And I think clearly Jesus' ministry is recalling the community back to this covenant. And I'm not necessarily giving anything particularly new, but trying to restore the old covenant in a way that does become new for us. So I would not automatically assume that just because the Hebrew people killed, that meant that this allowed that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Expanding on what the gentleman was saying about, I should know his name, but I'm sorry, I don't, about perhaps reading too much into this. No, perhaps at this point of Israel's moral development, maybe it was necessary to take a very, very simple law and say this is it, and later on, that it was possible to develop their moral sensibilities beyond that. Maybe this is all they could handle at the time.
Yes.
As far as the prophets, don't forget Prophet Elijah after the contest with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. Let none of them escape. So it wasn't the prophets who were in vain against the killing, but in many cases, or according to the Old Testament, in many cases, that was God's punishment to the Israelites in the wilderness, death. So perhaps at this point of the game, this was a step up from where they had been, but they still had a long way to go. As when Christ said, it was of old, but I say to you, I come not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, and this was the fulfilling of it.
Sure. Yes.
I think that that's an interesting idea, that there is a linear progression to civilization. And I know that I used to think that, and I think it used to be a more common hope and view, and I guess maybe just getting older, I really don't believe that anymore. I don't anymore believe in onward and upward. I think that it's just struggle all the way. And maybe they were wrestling with the same tension between the sacredness of life and being in the midst of killing at every moment that we are then as we are now. Maybe that's the whole thing, is to try to maintain a balance between those things.
Yeah. In some sense, in all of the, in all of the Decalogue, in all of the commandments, they're just laid out there. And we now have to begin to wrestle with them. And our desire is to make it very black and white. And it means yes here and no here, and it's okay here and it's not okay there, rather than living in that tension constantly back and forth and saying if it may be appropriate and it may not be appropriate. It'd be much easier for me to live, though, if I knew exactly. Yes. To lay it out so I could respond much easier. Yes.
But see, what he was asking, you know, is why did God say this? Or, you know, why? Whenever you say something negative, it supposedly is because you have another value that's a positive value. And so if you say, do not kill, what God was saying was because there is something of value here. So was he creating the value system of this new community, which up to this point had no identity in a sense, other than they were ancestors of Abraham, Jacob, and so on like that, and that the Ten Commandments become kind of this identifying mark or value system for this new community. They are different than the rest. They are called by God to be his people for his purpose.
Which was comment earlier, is that this is a new...
And in this community, life is of value.
I don't want to cut that off, and we could go endlessly on that, obviously. But I want to share the story here now, and then come back with some time to look at the roles within that story, and power and powerlessness, and perhaps even reassigning the cast of characters of who you might identify within this story. There are different possibilities of who you might see yourself as in this story. The story builds around Luther's explanation to the commandment from the Small Catechism, as well as from the large, where he fleshes it out even more. You shall not kill. We are to fear and love God so that we do not do harm to anyone but help them in every way. Have you ever killed someone, taken the life of another, acted as a murderer? The Nelson boys, Neil and Teal, no one could tell them apart, which was all the better for the two of them. Most people simply referred to them as the Nelson boys, and boys they were. Boys who were big for their ages. They stood an inch, if not 3 inches, taller than anyone else in their class. The joke which circulated the halls of school to explain their large size was that they failed to pass from one grade to the next. Some kids in private, never in public, would hear that one of the Nelson boys might overhear it, would say it was kindergarten which they flunked 2 consecutive years. With one look at Neil and Teal, you knew that you did not want to speak to these boys, and you hoped that they would not speak to you either. But then they never did speak. They growled. And they had a way of speaking without opening their lips, without moving their mouth. Excuse me, it should be without opening their mouth or without moving their lips. And this feat made them look all the more impressive. It took true skill to be able to master such an enterprise, or else sheer stupidity to stand in front of a mirror to practice such a senseless endeavor. Whichever was the case, the Nelson boys had it down pat, and they used it all the time. Not even the speech therapist who they saw every day could get them to open their mouth. The playground at Helen Baker Elementary School was owned and operated by the Nelson boys. There was nothing that took place on the tar lot, the swings, the slide, the ball diamond, or the monkey bars that was not under the supervision of Neil and Teal. They decided who played where and what they played. They dictated the outcome of a kickball game, and of course, they always won. They ruled a runner safe or out from across the schoolyard blocked by a dozen or more people with no objections from anyone. To maintain their authority on and off the playground or in the lunchroom, where they were always the first to eat, for no one objected to their stepping in line, or in the music room, where they always played whatever instrument they wanted, for no one told, no one squealed to the teacher that Neo or Teo took their instrument. To maintain such authority, which they used even against the teachers and the administration, to maintain such authority, every day they picked out one kid, one innocent, terrified little kid to push around. I'm not so sure how they decided which kid would be led to slaughter on any particular day, but the not knowing added to the fear. It might have been the first kid they saw, the first kid they heard speak, or maybe they even threw darts at a list of names before coming to school. Whatever the case may have been, it did not change the outcome for their victim. As the Nelson boys patrol the halls and the playground, they carried at all times a chip on their shoulder and a closed fist at their side, so that even if you were not the sacrificial lamb for the day, you were not safe from a punch in the stomach, an elbow to the head, a foot to the shin, and a shoulder push into the lockers. That just simply was life at Helen Baker School. I had never been their lamb for the day, although I had experienced on more than one occasion a fist to the stomach, a punch on the arm, a pulling of my hair. But by and large, I had fared pretty well as far as the Nelson boys were concerned. That was until the divorce of my parents became common knowledge. That event appeared to be all that it took for me to become the lamb to be sacrificed. On Monday morning, as I arrived at school and passed through the gray steel door, I knew my time had come. Surprisingly, I survived the day rather well. The neighborhood boys even commented how well I looked and felt at the end of the school day. Unfortunately, that was not to be the end. I was to become a special case. My persecution, my torment, my death, unlike my fellow classmates, was to be slow and drawn out. For some unknown reason, Neil and Teal thought I would make a good case study for their extreme measures of force, an example of discomfort and agony they could inflict over an extended period of time. Maybe it was that the odds were finally catching up with me. I had survived their punishment too long, and this was to make up for it. Or maybe it was that now, coming from a broken family, I somehow deserved this treatment. Whatever the rationale, and no one ever asked the Nelson boys if they had a rationale, but whatever it was sufficient to drive Neo and Teal for a week. And not only in school, not only on the playground, but even as I walked the three blocks home from school, they lay in waiting. I'm not sure which hurt more, the punches, the shoves into the locker, having my hairline rearranged, being spit on, or listening to the endless insults. Not merely the names they called me, names I had never heard before, words I had never thought of putting together, but it was more the things they said about my parents, the things they were telling the whole world. You see, my life no longer had a private side. It was no longer my decision to decide what I would reveal. For now, like laundry hung out to dry, my whole life was blowing in the spring breeze. Each morning as I arrived at school, I told myself, today they will choose a new person, and I will have survived their punishment. But each morning that week, there stood Neil and Teal outside my classroom, waiting, lips pressed tightly together, fist clenched, causing the knuckles to rise high above the fist, to form white caps like the snow on the mountains. They were older, much older, and for that reason, they were not in my grade, and yet they greeted me with a growl and a punch or two, which felt like a mountain falling down on me. When Friday arrived, and having passed through their good morning greeting, I was not sure how much more of this I was prepared to take. During the first hour of school, as I sat through reading class, I was thankful that it was Friday and that tomorrow there would be no school, which also meant no Neil and Teal. And then Sunday would follow, and again, no Neil and Teal. But as I basked in the sunlight of pleasure, a horrifying thought came to my mind.
Monday? What if Monday came and I was still the Lamb who refused to die, the one of my classmates? Continue to read from the textbook about the adventures of traveling to grandmother's house alone on the train, but I needed to pay no attention because I had my own adventures to be concerned about. Was this to be my new life? Not only did I not have a father at home, but now at school, was I to be the boy whose books were always spread across the floor, whose hair was never in place, whose arms were black and blue, whose shins hurt, whose ears would never be out of the reach of Neil and Teal. Sitting in reading class, staring at the words on the page and listening to no one's voice but my own, I decided that this had gone far enough. I would take no more. I would stand up to the Nelson boys. Yet the smarter half objected, violently objected. No one, including the teachers, stood up to Neil and Teal, and now I thought I could. Surely I wanted to die, so the voice spoke. But even death, I reassured myself, would be better than this. Approaching the gray steel doors to go outside after lunch, the doors armed with a long bar handle stretching across the width just below the window, chest high, I knew the Nelson boys would be on the other side, already fouling up the fresh spring air with their commands. Reaching the door all too quickly and throwing my body against the metal door to open the prison doors, sure enough, there stood Neil and Teal. There they stood under the flat portion of the roof, waiting, already speaking, but not letting their lips move, already dictating who went where and who played what on that day. As I passed by, as far to the right as possible, they flung some insults and stepped forward to swing a punch, but I objected. The voice within, which spoke earlier during reading class, now spoke outwardly. I told them to leave me alone. In that moment, it was as if all the world was wearing headphones and heard my objections. My buddies, wanting to get out of the way, quickly passed on my right and warned, "Don't be stupid. Just do whatever they say." Stepping forward with my right leg to follow, I felt a hand pressed down on my left shoulder. It was Neil, I think, or maybe Teal. It was one of the Nelson boys who halted my progress while the other circled round in front of me and spit in my face, and he bit his lips to interrogate me and said, "What did you say, kid?" Now I thought to myself, after a week of abuse, they still didn't know my name. What kind of fools were they? But I didn't say that to them. Rather, I answered very softly, hoping that they would not hear me. I said, "Leave me alone." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my best friend shaking his head and his eyes pleading with me just to keep still. But it was already too late for that. They heard. Neil, or Teal, whichever it was, moved his hand from my shoulder to my arm and pulled it behind my back and began to lift it upwards until it would go no farther. And the other, whoever it was, who stood in front of me, stepped forward with his fist raised, ready to strike me. I prepared my face for the pain it was about to receive, and I screamed out in anger. In the moments that followed, I lost all consciousness, and I can only tell you what happened as told to me by others. I struck the Nelson boy in front of me with my right fist and somehow freed myself from the other behind and began to punch and to wail insults at Neil and Teal. And by the time the teachers pulled me from Neil and Teal, blood flowed from their noses and from above their eyes. No longer were their lips pressed tightly together, for now they sobbed uncontrollably. I was not permitted to stand by and to watch the events which followed out on the playground, for by the collar of my shirt I was dragged to the principal's office, where I sat and waited for judgment to be passed. I did not hear it, but supposedly out on the playground I went from being a lamb to some kind of a hero. And I wish the story could end there with me being a hero. in my mind, if there was ever anyone who deserved to be beat up, to be put in their place, it was the Nelson boys. As I sat in the secretary's office and watched the kids pass by the glass window and wave their congratulations, I felt important. I suppose something like a boxer, a warrior, perhaps even a hero. Yes, a hero. After all, this was the Nelson boys I destroyed. They were broken. They were brought low. They were not so strong after all. They were crushed in the eyes of the school. I had done what no one else had done. I had done the very thing every kid had dreamed of doing. So why didn't I feel like a hero? Why was I trying to convince myself I was? So why was that voice within repeating, "You've done good"? As I sat waiting for the principal to call me into his office, as I sat staring at the long black hand of the clock tick its way ever closer to the 12, with my hands becoming wet with fear, I began to question. My stomach told me something was not right. It hurt. Not like any pain from a punch either Neo or Teal could have thrown. It was much more painful. It hurt not from the outside in, but rather from the inside out. The pain came deep from within. What had I accomplished? So I bloodied the Nelson boys. The only thing to change would be that they would now leave me alone. And had I really made the school a safer place? For a moment, as I thought of the kids who passed by the window and waved, I tried to convince myself I had, but I knew better. The only thing I had done was forced Neo and Teal into a position where they had to fight all the more to prove that they were somebody, that they could be tough. I had not changed anything, except perhaps to shut the door to lock and bolt any future between myself and the Nelson boys. All I succeeded in doing was to murder both Neo and Teal, and I murdered them. My desire was not to make Helen Baker's school a safer place, but only to do bodily harm to Neil and Teal, to destroy everything they stood for and everything they had done to me. I killed another human being in order to even the score, and for a moment I was proud of my feat, proud for I was the king of the hill, but some hill I stood upon. You see, now I was no better than either Neil or Teal. I answered evil with evil. I killed for the pure pleasure of killing. Even before the principal's door opened, I knew I was wrong. Some hero. Have you ever killed someone, taken the life of another, acted as a murderer? It need not occur with your hands or fists, with a weapon such as a gun, but perhaps it came with the sword within the sheath of your mouth. The tongue is just as lethal and just as deadly. We kill with deeds and with lack of deeds. We bring death upon another, and in some strange way, we often pride ourselves on the way in which we stepped upon another, the manner in which we made someone else look foolish or silly, someone else look inferior to us. Perhaps it's by our physical or athletic abilities, by our intellectual gifts, or by the simple act of cutthroat antics, we punch until they bleed. Bleed from their eyes, bleed from within, for they are broken, destroyed, finally killed. I have seen the faces of Neil and Teal bleeding and crying out for help, crying for me to stop and to offer some aid, some assistance, many times since that day out on the playground, and I just have continued to pass by. I have even thrown the final fatal punch, and I have been proud of ending another suffering and misery. I have seen their bloody faces on the street corner, on a dark, lonely highway, on a mother surrounded by hungry children, on a struggling father, on a war-torn victim, on a confused visitor, even on an old friend. Countless times I have seen Neo and Teal again and again and again, and still I refuse to stop punching, to get off their bodies, and to help them. Oh God, how I have killed. Oh God, forgive me. Forgive us, for we have sinned against you and against your children. Oh God, forgive us. forgive us by the death of Jesus, that we may stop and cease this senseless need to kill. Power and powerlessness, and it's the very thing that Ray got at as the moment I became powerful and killed Neil and Teal, I actually became powerless. And in some sense, their power all that time and all their activity really was their powerlessness. To look at the characters in that story differently. And ultimately, who had power in that story? I hope we have a couple of minutes left. Yeah, five.
Well, everyone had power, whether or not they used it.
Yeah. Definitely.
Do you mean actual power or simply perceived as having power?
Both. Actual power, perceived power.
Yes, perceived power can sometimes be more powerful than...
than the actual power one has. Yes. Yes.
Did those school kids, if they had gotten together, have power if they...
Yeah. True. Sure. We never did. We're just too scared. Yeah. Someone made an interesting comment that I had never thought of prior to this is, how come I got dragged to the principal's office and Neil and Teal never did? What was the power of the principal and action there? Well, in some senses, I think back about back to those days, Neil and Teal were in the principal's office all the time. But in some sense, as I alluded to, the administration was just powerless over them. Not over me, because I guess I adhered to that. I feared that power.
Maybe their mom were VIPs in the community.
Yeah. I think that's always the case. I know there are many, many teachers here, and you only have power over a student or anyone if the student accepts your power. You're powerless unless someone says, okay, you're my boss.
Yeah,
I suppose. Well, also, if you have something to lose, and they have the power to help you lose it.
Okay.
Because if you get to people who have nothing to lose anymore.
Sure.
You know, I remember reading those. I don't know if it was Corrie Ten Boom or something like that, but one of those people in the Holocaust situation in one of the prison camps, that when the soldiers took everything away, thinking they really did something to them, they freed them up.
Yeah.
Because they had nothing more to lose, and they were free finally.
Yeah. Insight there for the people of South America, I mean, is that, or from Central America, is that a similar powerlessness there, that in some sense that powerlessness does become, or not?
No, I when you said that, I was thinking the exact same thing. I think that is very much what happens in situations like that, is that people don't have anything else to lose. And so, they're willing to take risks that we would never dream of in order to reclaim some sense of dignity and power. The other thing that I was thinking of during the story related to El Salvador is, I told this yesterday in my session, but a friend of mine who's North American who's been working in a small little village and church in El Salvador talks about having numerous conversations with soldiers in the Salvadoran Armed Forces, and how he would just talk to them about various things, but sometimes in conversations their church activities would come up, and he would ask them, find out a little bit more about whether or not they've been involved in the church or whether they consider themselves to be Christian. And he said in all of those conversations, only one person, who happened to be an officer, ever said that he still was a Christian. That the response of everyone else was, I used to be. Or maybe I will be again when I leave the army. But there was some kind of moral, they were incapable of reconciling participating in the Salvadoran Armed Forces and being a Christian. So there was some way in which as you were saying, once they participated in what they had been doing, that they gave up any kind of moral integrity, and they gave up, in some sense, any kind of power, even though they're seen as having the power, they gave up any kind of moral power, and they couldn't reconcile that for themselves, so in their minds, they had to no longer consider themselves to be Christians.